Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last year, Columbus was named a finalist for a form of transportation known as a Hyperloop. The proposed route would connect Chicago, Columbus, and Pittsburgh with trains that travel in large tubes at speeds exceeding 600 miles per hour. That sounds like science fiction, but Central Ohio officials are taking it seriously. A delegation recently traveled to Nevada to take a look at Hyperloop technology. Joining us now by phone is the Director of Transportation Systems and Funding for Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission, which planned the excursion, Thea Walsh. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning, Ann.
Can you describe what a Hyperloop does?
Sure. So it's like traveling by train, but inside a tube at very fast speeds. So, for instance, from Columbus to Chicago, you could get there in under 30 minutes at their projected speeds that the technology will be working towards reaching, and you could make it to Pittsburgh in under 20 minutes.
Are there any Hyperloops operating anywhere in the world?
So the only operating test track is in the United States. It's actually in Nevada, and we have the opportunity to test it. But currently it is a test site where no people or actual cargo are riding on it today.
So you weren't able to even get a bit of a taste?
No. We were able to see the facility and what it takes to make it work, but no people have ever rode on it yet.
Tech billionaire Elon Musk made the idea of a Hyperloop famous, but the company working on Midwest Connect route is not his. Tell us about Virgin Hyperloop One.
Certainly, Virgin Hyperloop One is one of actually a couple of different companies that are pursuing this technology. They have been doing this for a couple years now. Basically, the paper that Elon Musk wrote with his colleagues is open source, and so this company took that. And so we're going to build a prototype, and we're going to start looking at routes around the United States. And really, that open invitation is where we got involved. So really excited to be at this point with this company.
Do you have a sense of what being a passenger in one of these trains would be like?
Yeah, so, I mean, not from true experience, for sure, but getting to go out to the site meant we got to talk to some experts about different types of, you could ask the questions like, what will this feel like? Mm-hmm. And, you know, will it, like, because of the vacuum tube, will I be able to breathe? You know, things like that. And they explained it to us, like, it's actually, it's more locked tight than, say, an airplane.
I'm sorry, Thea, we just lost you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can. You said it's more locked tight than an airplane?
Yes, so they described it as being more Loctite than an airplane as far as air goes, but it as far as the feeling, it's more like a train or a plane. You know, it's that same feeling, except for there's even less air go in and out.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the Hyperloop proposal and whether Central Ohio and Columbus can become part of a link between Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Columbus. It would be about 20 minutes to Pittsburgh and about 30 minutes to Chicago from Columbus. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Thea Walsh. She's Director of Transportation Systems and Funding for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission, which planned an excursion to Las Vegas where the only test track for the Hyperloop exists right now. Thea, where is the city in the selection process at this point?
Actually, the entire process is over, and we are a winner. We're one of 10 winners around the world, and the other three in the United States include a line between Austin, Houston, and Dallas, and the Texas Triangle. a Orlando to Miami corridor in Florida, and a corridor around the Denver area in Colorado, and ours, of course. So,
and so there's around the world. What are the chances? I mean, how seriously are you taking this?
Well, we're taking this very seriously. We have been looking at this corridor for other transportation technologies connecting us to Chicago. So as we pursue that corridor, the studies that you would do, say, for passenger rail or other types of, you know, new emerging technologies would be the same studies in these early phases that you would do for this. And so we're taking it one step at a time and looking at the feasibility of this particular technology along with others in that corridor.
How or is Columbus working with Chicago and Pittsburgh on this?
So it's been a great partnership, very much in a Central Ohio way. We've kind of expanded that same camaraderie and partnership out across this line. In fact, this corridor between here and Chicago, those communities have been talking together about at least passenger rail connection on that corridor since 2013.
Exactly.
So we already have a built relationship.
Right. And I was wondering if that would conflict with Hyperloop, if the Hyperloop is a distraction from that other passenger rail plan.
No, absolutely not. It's seen as momentum. It's an opportunity. At this, like I mentioned, at this stage of the game, a lot of the information could be used to go either direction. And so it's just good information to have for making these connection decisions. And then our partners in Pittsburgh have been great as well, as we've added them into the corridor as part of this proposal.
Okay, I'm going to go to William from Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, William.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, all right.
Quick question. Yeah, I lived in Japan forever, and trains were just part of the culture. You happen to know how much it's going to maybe cost to ride, say, from here to Chicago compared to, like, a plane ticket?
Yeah. What do we know, Thea? How will it compare to flying?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and really the feasibility study will give us that information. So that is really the next step we're taking to determine basically what it would take to build this here, and then as a result of that, the cost per ticket and the kind of next steps from that. So that will certainly be a part of what we learn.
What do you want to see it be for people? Do you want to see it be kind of an egalitarian form of transportation that most people can afford?
Well, certainly that's not only a personal mission of mine, but that is our understanding from Hyperloop as well. Hyperloop One is that when we read about it, that is kind of their striving to bring down that cost in their when they work on costing out these feasibility studies. So that's something we're certainly going to be eyeballing and making sure that is equal for our consumers here in Central Ohio and the Midwest.
What are you anticipating the investment from states and cities will be in all of this?
I think it's just really early to know that. I mean, certainly we have partners who have partnered with us on small studies and things to get to this part. And so those are really kind of insignificant in the overall larger sense. But I think it's definitely going to take a little bit of everybody partnering together to make this work. So I think the private sector will be as involved as the public sector in this.
Would the Hyperloop be something that you could see from existing roadways?
I guess it just depends on where it's built. Right now, it's proposed along a rail corridor.
Okay,
Yeah. Yeah, so it could possibly be seen from roadways.
What sets the Midwest apart from some of the other proposals around the world? Do you have a sense for that yet?
So one large focus of our study and our proposal is on freight. We move a lot of freight through Central Ohio and through the Midwest. And so really talking about the impact on business, first and foremost, and how this could make a an opportunity for businesses moving a lot of goods through the Midwest and through the country as being kind of a central point for making that happen. And then, you know, for the added bonus for us is the passenger movement, but really that first piece being moving freight and what it could do for our economy.
I understand that there is a decision or an announcement being made in a couple weeks. Any chance of giving us a hint about what that might be?
Certainly. So we are actually getting ready to work with Hyperloop One on our next steps. And so that's what that's all going to be about, is the next steps we plan to take with them and how we plan to work together and basically how long that is going to take and what that will tell us.
If the Chicago, Columbus, Pittsburgh link is chosen, hypothetically, how long would it be before we might see this Hyperloop? Would I be able to ride on it, do you think, at my advanced age?
So that's a really good question, too. As a planner, we plan 20 years out. But what I can tell you about this new and exciting world of transportation planning is that everything is moving faster than it ever has before. I mean, just like the Smart Columbus and 33 corridor, you know, we're doing things quicker than we've ever done them. And this company is kind of bucking that system too and saying they want to get something actually up and working in the 2020 timeframe, you know, that timeframe. And so I don't know that that means it's in Central Ohio, but what I'm saying is that, you know, it really just depends on the ability of this company to get their technology off the ground and the federal government and the state governments to work on standards for it. But, you know, the sky's the limit. And, you know, quite possibly you could see that happen.
Well, the federal and state government aren't known for speed when it comes to putting things together and creating standards and that sort of a thing. And also, there's been a lot of pushback, not on the Hyperloop question, but on high-speed rail in the past. In fact, Governor Kasich turned away about $750 million from the federal government to develop high-speed rail. What is your sense about the reaction from them regarding this?
So I will say there is a lot of focus by our state on smart transportation implementation, so basically innovation in the area of transportation. And really, this is no different from any of those pieces. In fact, we have a close working relationship with the state of Ohio on this particular subject, and they have been at the table with us. Actually, they were on a call with us with Hyperloop One, and they were actually scheduled to be on the trip with us, but unfortunately, their representative wasn't able to make it on that day, but still very supportive. So we've continued to have success with our state. And we've also invited the state of Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Illinois to join us in Washington when we were working on standards with a couple other Hyperloop states, and they joined us. So it continues to build, if you will. And there seems to be interest not only in the state of Ohio, but multiple other states. And as a result of that, the federal government is listening.
Thea Walsh, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Anne. It's always great to share what's new in transportation with you.
Thea Walsh is the Director of Transportation Systems and Funding for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. They recently organized an expedition to Las Vegas to check out the Hyperloop proposal out there where they have a test track. More Tech Tuesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This month, Facebook announced it would be making changes to its news feed. That could mean changes to what the more than 2 billion users see as they scroll through the social media platform. It could also have consequences for media companies who have come to rely on the Facebook ecosystem for their content. Joining us by phone to talk about these changes at Facebook is tech writer for Slate, Will Oremus. Welcome back.
Thanks, Jen.
So what are the changes that Facebook plans to put into place?
There are a slew of changes that Facebook is rolling out this year, and they're all around the theme of trying to address some of the ways that Facebook has basically disrupted and broken our media system and the way information works in our democracy and other democracies around the world. The latest changes are led by some changes to the news feed, wherein you're going to see fewer posts from professional pages. So that's publishers, the New York Times, the Columbus Dispatch. You're going to see fewer posts from brands that you might have followed at one point or another, more posts from your actual friends and family. And one of the upshots of that will be that you see less news in your feed. Now, it's not a drastic change. You'll see, the company has estimated, you'll see about 80% as much news in your Facebook feed as you used to. But more of that will be the news that's being shared by your friends and family rather than the news that's coming directly from the publishers you follow on Facebook.
Well, isn't that part of the problem, though, is that so many people are getting their news from friends and family and not from looking at the front page of a newspaper?
Yeah, that's right. And so there are ways that that particular change could backfire when it comes to the problem of misinformation and sensationalism and stories that just reinforce all the political biases we already had. That said, Facebook is sort of taking a two-pronged approach. So its justification for the newsfeed changes that I mentioned is actually less about the media and news and more about research that the company says suggests that that sort of passive consumption of content, whether it's news or videos, on Facebook is bad for you and makes you less happy and more depressed, whereas connecting with friends and family is good for you and has positive effects on your well-being. But when it comes to addressing the problem with news, there's actually another change that's relevant, and that is that Facebook is going to start trying to assess the trustworthiness of various news sources. That's a really tricky task. It's one that Facebook has intentionally avoided in the past because it doesn't want to be in the business of saying, hey, you should trust this newspaper, but not this other newspaper. That's a rag. But it's finally come around to the view that it has to do something like this if it wants to really address the problem.
All right. Two issues, and they both revolve around money. Aren't news organizations paying Facebook for these post opportunities?
Well, right. So there are two separate ways that news organizations and other professional pages on Facebook, other organizations on Facebook, can reach people. One is what's known in the industry as organic reach. And that's when, let's say you're a news organization and you just post a story to your Facebook page and it will show up in the feeds of the people who follow you, presumably, although we now know that fewer of those people will see your post than they did before. So the organic reach is going down. But there's also what's called paid reach. And that's where, you're a news organization or you're a brand of some sort, and you pay some amount of money to Facebook to make sure that your post appears in the feeds of a certain subset of users. And you can decide what kind of users you want to see it. You can say, I want it to appear in the feeds of, women between 40 and 60 who are professionals and have an interest in, CSI Miami or whatever. So the paid reach option will still be there. It's the organic reach that's being suppressed now.
And any concern by anybody that when you leave it to an organization like a profitable organization like or a profit oriented one like Facebook, that they could be bought?
Yeah, I mean, Facebook, Facebook has been making money hand over fist lately. And it's funny, the company's in a funny position because it's making more money than ever before. From a business standpoint, it's on a huge roll. It's now one of the most valuable companies in the world because along with Google, it dominates online advertising. So the business is doing great, but at the same time, the company is under all of this criticism and scrutiny, partly due to its perceived role in the 2016 U.S. election and Brexit, but also in other democracies and other societies around the world where it's being exploited by foreign agents and hackers, where it seems to be being used by governments to crack down on citizens. So the Facebook, the company, is going in two directions at once. And what it's trying to do now is kind of reconcile that by stepping back and saying, well, look, what if we stopped focusing on profit for a second? Because we've got plenty of money. What if we tried to address these huge PR issues that we have and these ways in which our product may actually be harming society? Maybe in the long run, that's going to result in a more sustainable business than just focusing on maximizing engagement and ad revenue in the short run.
Is that algorithm that promoted sensationalism, tribalism, and partisan pandering that you wrote about?
Yeah, I mean, so Facebook's news algorithm does a lot of things, and it certainly is not designed intentionally to promote partisan pandering or tribalism or that sort of thing. But it's built into the very design of Facebook. I mean, the idea of Facebook's newsfeed algorithm is that it's going to show you the posts that it thinks you're most likely to engage with in some way, whether that's clicking on a story or hitting like or commenting or sharing it with your friends. Now, when it does that, it just turns out, this wasn't Facebook's intention necessarily, but that people love to click on and share and like stuff that appeals to their gut reactions, you know, stuff that they can get behind, stuff they can rally around, stuff that gets them outraged or angry or excited. And it's not stuff that would tend to challenge their worldview or present a nuanced argument that might, you know, that might cause them to reflect and consider things in a new way. That stuff just doesn't resonate in the same way when you're skimming through your feed on the app on your phone, you know, in the 10 minutes while you're waiting to meet somebody for an appointment or something. So I wouldn't say that Facebook does that on purpose, but I think that in the process of trying to give people what they want, they end up doing things like reinforcing people's biases and making them more political views because they see stuff and like stuff from people that they already agree with.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Willa Ramis, tech writer for Slate, about changes in Facebook, changing what we see, how much news feed we see. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You wrote, Will, about how many companies made a shift toward producing more videos because of Facebook and because of how it operates. How will that change or not?
Yeah, so Facebook periodically decides that some form of content or another is the future and that we should all be doing more of that. And so a few years back, it decided that video was the thing. It started auto-playing videos in your feed. So that's when you scroll down through your feed and then the video just starts playing even before you click on anything. And so it encouraged companies, publishers, media companies to make videos that would work for this format, make videos that would start playing in people's feeds and that they would like or that they would sit and watch for a little bit as they scrolled through. A lot of companies, because Facebook has become so influential, I mean, this is the underlying story here, is that more and more people are just getting news on their phone on Facebook as opposed to tuning into an evening newscast or reading the morning paper or even navigating to the website of their favorite media outlet. They're just getting it all in one place. You know, Facebook is sort of one-stop shopping for updates from your friends and news from around the world. And the result of that has been that media companies have had to shift their entire strategies in many cases just to reach the same people who they used to reach directly. Now they have to reach them through Facebook. So if Facebook says, video is the thing, then you'll get a bunch of media companies saying, oh, video, let's do more video. And that's exactly what happened. And it was called, in the industry, it was called the pivot to video. All these companies that used to do articles started doing news videos. A couple years later, Facebook said, you know what? We decided that passively consuming video in your feed is bad for you. So we're not going to do that anymore. And now all these companies are out of luck.
They're just out of luck. It's not important to Facebook's future in general, then.
Well, you know, Facebook still sees video as, I think, as an important part of its future, but it has shifted its thinking around what kind of video that might be. Its latest thinking is, instead of having media companies publish videos that autoplay in your feed and that you just kind of lazily watch as you're scrolling down, now they're going to try to encourage forms of video that they think are likely to make people respond or react or interact with each other in some way. So, for example, Facebook has this new product called Facebook Watch. It's a hub for these sort of TV show-like videos that are professionally produced. They're a little longer. They have a plot sometimes, or they're funny. You go there and watch it, and Facebook will tell you if your friend has watched it too, and it will actually encourage you to discuss the show with your friend or with other people who are watching it at the same time. And Facebook claims that this is sort of a healthier form of interaction because you're actually connecting with people rather than just staring slack-jawed at your screen. Whether that's actually the case, I think, is debatable, but that's Facebook's new thing, and so you're going to see companies, when Facebook says jump, they say how high, and I think that's where companies are headed now.
When can everyday users of Facebook expect to see noticeable changes in their experience? I know I was notified by Facebook. They didn't say I was going to see less news. They said I'm going to hear more from my friends and family, kind of a thing. But I'm not sure I notice any big difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. Facebook is very sophisticated about the way it implements these changes. Whenever it changes its algorithm, it does a test first with a tiny group of people, a tiny randomly selected group of people, just to make sure that it actually works and to see if they are using Facebook more or less than before. If they're using it less than before, then Facebook never rolls out the change and you never see it as an average user. Facebook also has focus groups that it surveys. You know, when it makes a change, it says, hey, do you like this better? Is it working for you? Does it make you feel better about Facebook? Once it's gone through all those processes, then they roll it out to the public. But even then, they usually do it in a somewhat modest form. So you probably won't notice immediate drastic changes to what you see in your feed. You know, if you look carefully, you might realize that you're seeing fewer posts. Like, let's say you've followed NPR on Facebook, you might realize that you're seeing fewer posts from NPR lately in your feed. It's that kind of slow evolution. And then over time, if Facebook finds that this works the way they hoped, then they kind of ratchet that up. And a year or two from now, you might think to yourself, wow, I know I liked the NPR page 3 years ago, but I haven't seen a post from them in a year.
Would the only way to change that then be to go to the NPR, check it out on your own, and then start to change the trajectory there?
Yeah, and you know, again, it's all personalized. So if NPR is one of the few places you really follow, the few pages you really follow on Facebook, and you love it, and every time you see something from NPR in your feed, you end up clicking on it or liking it or commenting it, you'll probably still see it there. Facebook also does give, this is sort of little known, but Facebook does give you the power to see posts from a certain person, whether it's a friend or a page like NPR, at the top of your feed every time when you log in. There's a little option to do that. But Facebook has found in general that most people don't like having to take fine-grained manual control over their feeds in that way. And Facebook is very happy to just let the algorithm do the work for you.
Has the announcement had any impact on Facebook's stock value?
So when Facebook first announced the changes related to seeing more posts from friends and family and fewer posts from publishers, they actually did see a dip in their stock. That's unusual for Facebook because they've been, doing so well financially lately. I think people were just trying to figure out what exactly Facebook meant. I mean, the way it presented these changes, it presented them in a sort of soul-searching way, saying, hey, we're realizing that Facebook might not be good for people in some ways. You know, there could be harmful effects from spending too much time on Facebook. They're starting to look at the research that suggests that. They're doing the same thing now. They had a post this week where they talk about the ways in which Facebook could be bad for democracy. It's very unusual. It really is out of the ordinary to see a large public company publicly questioning whether it does harm in the world. I mean, you don't see that from, even cigarette companies, but that's exactly the kind of soul searching Facebook is engaged in right now. And, if you want to be cynical about it, you can say it's because they realize that unless they can improve their public image, then they're going to get subject to laws, antitrust regulations from Congress. People might stop using Facebook, that sort of thing. But I think you can also give them some credit that they really are taking seriously the ways in which Facebook might be harming society in various respects. And, of course, that makes investors jittery to hear. But I think it's probably the right move for them long term.
That it's getting a soul and it's not just profit driven, that it's also worried about the existential threat to the world.
Yeah, and again, it has to be worried about this stuff. I mean, it's not like Facebook came out on its own and said, oh, we're really worried that we're causing harm in the world. The media and critics have been beating this drum for years, mm-hmm. saying Facebook is bad for society in all sorts of ways, and they refuse to own up to it. Well, now Facebook finally is owning up to it, and I think it is genuine, and they deserve some credit for that. What comes out of it, though, will be interesting. It's always going to be that incentive for them to, when they find a problem, like, oh, okay, well, people are sad, you know, made more sad when they just spend a lot of time passively consuming stuff in their feed. Facebook has an incentive to fix that with more Facebook, right? Like, well, let's find a way to give them other content that will make them happier, and not let's find a way to break their addiction to Facebook and get them to spend less time on here, because that would be obviously bad for the bottom line.
Do you think the changes might lead to less polarization and fake news on Facebook, or could it still be played by, you know, actors from around the world?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's too early to tell. I think you hit on something early on in our conversation, which is that this move from seeing posts directly from news outlets to seeing posts shared by your friends and family could actually make the problem worse. That's a problem that has been called the filter bubble problem. And it's the idea that when you see stuff from people you already know and like, those ideas are likely to be things that just reinforce the worldview you already had. And so you get more and more entrenched in those views. So, you know, I think that could continue to be a problem. I do think their new effort to look at the trustworthiness of news sources is really interesting. And it's going to potentially catch them a lot of flack, because liberals and conservatives are both going to be very vigilant looking out for whether Facebook is treating their preferred publications unfairly. You know, is Facebook rating Fox News as more credible than MSNBC or vice versa? That could outrage people. And that's the type of thing that gets you hauled before congressional hearings, you know, when politicians want to make hay mm-hmm. over that sort of thing. So there's a big risk here, but I think there's also real potential. I mean, there's no way to perfectly rate the credibility of various publishers, but on a broad stroke scale, Facebook should be able to tell the difference between a major news outlet, whether that's Fox News or MSNBC, and one of these fake news sites that a teenager in Macedonia dreamed up to try to trick people into thinking that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, or that, you know, whatever conspiracy theory that they're churning out lately. That's a determination that Facebook should be able to make relatively easily. And I think that has the potential to help a lot if they can start to let people know in various ways whether the news that they're seeing is coming from a credible outlet or from some fly-by-night site.
And so much of that depends on whether they can maintain a sense of credibility with people in general, Facebook.
Yeah, and I think that's really what a lot of this is about. I mean, Facebook recognizes that it is suddenly being seen as not just this, shouldn't say suddenly. I mean, this has been mm-hmm. a change that's been taking place over years, but it is really coming to be seen less as this fun thing that you can waste time on and connect with your friends over, and more as this hugely influential global corporate power that is changing the way we communicate and affecting democracies and elections in all sorts of ways that it never planned on. And so I think, you know, I think Facebook is recognizing that. I think you're seeing them try to address it, and there's probably going to be a lot of mistakes that they make along the way. But at least it seems like the intentions are there.
Will Oramus, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
Will Oramus, tech writer for Slate. We've been talking about the changes afoot at Facebook. You can read about it if you check out the link on our website at WOSU.org. We'll hook you up with Will Oramus's articles on this. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Since the advent of smartphone cameras and social media, people are sharing more and more of their lives with the world, sometimes oversharing. Google has a new device in the works that will make it easier to capture photos and video from daily life. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So tell us about Google Clips.
So Google Clips was something that was announced as kind of an early project that was being worked on back when the Google Pixel was announced. And it's this little camera that you can put in a couple of different configurations. You can either wear it on your shirt and just kind of capture the things that are happening in front of you. You can set up, in a corner of a room or on a table or something. The idea is that you set it somewhere or you wear it on yourself and it grabs images and video throughout the day and uses that information to kind of create collages of your life for you to see at the end of an event.
Weird. Okay, so how big is it? Like you said, it's small, like the size of a what?
It's not big at all. It's probably, half the size of a credit card and probably three times as thick, because you got to have space for the camera and the battery there. And it has a single button on it for when you know that you're seeing something that you want to take a good picture of so you can, get a picture of that thing that's happening right then and there. But it's really built to kind of act automatically and to work with Google Photos to kind of automatically assemble these clips of your life for you to enjoy. And it's not a new concept. It's pretty commonly known as life logging, but none of these cameras have ever really taken off. They've never been, super popular. And like you said, as soon as I described what this camera was, it gets viewed pretty frequently as being kind of a creepy concept.
It's creepy. But how does it know when to take photos or videos or whatever it does? It's not constantly running, right?
No, it's not constantly running. It bases itself on the environment, proximity to your phone because it is attached to your phone for some things. It probably has, microphone built in for high pitched noise. If you're celebrating a birthday and everyone starts singing, then that microphone would detect that as a thing that would be worth recording and just kind of automatically do that.
It produces a montage or a collage. So you don't actually have to sift through all of it to come up with something, right? It does it for you.
Right. That's the thing that makes this interesting is that Google Photos as an app has demonstrated over the last year in particular that it's very good at taking images and videos that you have taken and assembling them in ways that you wouldn't have done yourself, mm-hmm. so that you don't have to go through the effort of sifting through them. At the beginning of this month, I got a video of all of the different photos that I had taken through the last year of my daughter smiling. And that was how it presented it. Google Photos presented it as, smiles that you may have missed throughout 2017. And it was this really cute, kind of 60-second video that I got to just kind of watch myself. And so the idea is that Clips is now taking pictures that you wouldn't have thought to take and using that information to create those kind of memories for you.
Okay. How much is it going to cost?
They are $250 cameras.
Ooh.
Which is not cheap, and there's still a lot of stuff we don't know about this camera, like how good it is at taking pictures and videos, and whether it's going to be worth carrying around. So it's definitely a big ask, and Google has to demonstrate that it's not just this creepy camera that you have with you everywhere. But it's interesting to see a company as large as Google getting into this idea, this life logging idea, where basically, Google's artificial intelligence is now doing all of the work from taking the photos to assembling the collage to delivering it to you instead of, a project that you take upon yourself to do.
What do you think, Russell? Will this beat the competition? I mean, you said that these things haven't done very well in the past. What about this one?
Yeah, none of these have done pretty well. It's really going to entirely depend on how well it works. If Google is able to deliver an experience where someone can clip this camera to their shirt and take their family to the park or something, and at the end of the day have a really nice, set of videos and photos of that experience where the that person didn't have to take out their phone or take out their camera
right.
Every couple of minutes, then that could be something really special. But it's really going to depend on how good Google software is to pull that off.
Okay. Do we know when it's going to be released?
It will likely be released at the end of next month, but we don't have an official date yet.
Okay. All right. That gives it time to work out the kinks before next Christmas. We shall see how it does. Speaking of sharing photos and videos, you wanted to talk about a recent change to Instagram. What's the deal? It has to do with its show activity status?
Yeah, so Instagram, is constantly updating things in the background and adding new features for people to take a look at. And one of the features that was added very recently is a show activity status feature that just kind of appeared. They didn't really tell people that it was happening. And what it does is it lets you take a look at your friends list, and it tells you when those friends are online and actively using Instagram. So if you are somewhere using Instagram, you have the app open on your phone, any of your friends that also have the app open on their phone can look and see that you are online and available. Mm. And that is, that could be a useful feature to some people, but it is not a particularly useful feature to people who have, a massive friends list full of people that are total strangers.
Exactly.
Because it means that those people now know when you are and are not using Instagram, and that could be troubling to a bunch of people. So it was interesting that Instagram just kind of activated this feature and didn't really tell anybody about it, and that it's on by default for everyone. You have to go and turn it off if it's something that you don't want.
Yeah, I'm kind of having a blank here, but Facebook did a similar thing. I guess I never even look over there. It's on the right side of the page. Who's on, who's not?
Well, it's active as in the Facebook Messenger. If Facebook Messenger will show you when someone is on. So if you use the Messenger service, then yes, it will show you when that works. But you can, if you don't have the Messenger service on your phone, then it won't share that information just by having the Facebook app open.
What's it going to look like knowing how, if you are somebody who has lots of followers, what's that going to look like on Instagram?
It's really just it's a small icon that lights up on the screen and lets you know that that person is active, basically, that they are currently using Instagram or have used Instagram within the last couple of minutes.
Hmm, okay. This does have people a little creeped out, right?
It does, because, you're combining, there's a lot of information that can be combined here. Instagram is already not super great at showing you how to do things like turn off location tagging when mm-hmm. you post photos. So there's a lot of information that could potentially be combined about when you are using Instagram and where you are using Instagram that can make it a little easy to hunt you down.
Okay, so why did they do it?
Because this was something that they felt like their core audience of users was interested in having. And this was something that, gives more information about when people are active and what they might be doing. So if someone is getting ready to do something, maybe a video that's being posted or something like that, it's a way to stay connected to those people.
Oh, my gosh. A lot of other apps let you know if a message you sent has been seen by the recipient. Is that different?
No. So the message being seen by a recipient, read receipts are fairly common with a lot of different applications.
Yeah.
So that's not as big a deal, but it's another one of those features that, kind of gets turned on by default and has to be turned off.
Did you turn it off, Russell?
I turn off a lot of that stuff just because it's a lot easier to not have those features available. And especially when it comes to things like read receipts, because I'm not always super great about responding to people. And
yeah.
So I get to be a little deceptive and just be like, oh, I didn't get that message until just now.
Yeah.
Which is, I should probably be a little more honest about that stuff.
Well, you got to have some kind of privacy. You also wanted to talk about a popular video game that's coming to Xbox One. It's called Monster Hunter World.
Yes, Monster Hunter World.
Okay. What's it like?
This is a huge transformation of a game series that has been out for a while, and the idea here was really taking advantage of the capabilities of the Xbox to make this game look as realistic as possible. So the idea here is that you're in this massive kind of open world that is very visually attractive, and it's a role-playing game. So you create a character and you can roam around with other people playing the game and take part in this massive story where there are dragons and giant, other monsters and just kind of have some fun.
Is it scary?
It is. It has thriller elements to it. I wouldn't go so far as to call it scary. It's not like a horror game. You're not going to see, you know, things jump out at you or anything like that. But it does have moments that are designed to kind of put you at the edge of your seat and excite you.
It's been available on Sony and Nintendo platforms. What makes this special?
The idea here is that it's coming to the Xbox One as part of their HDR enhanced setup. Oh, okay. So with the release of the Xbox One X, the idea was, you know, connecting it to this, you know, your a big 4K television was going to make the game, you know, significantly better looking. And this is one of those games that actually takes advantage of the 4K high definition television.
How many hours of play can an average person get out of it? Not Russell Holly.
Oh, wow. That's not an easy question to answer. A lot of this kind of game, because it's just come out. There's a lot of this kind of game has a tendency to keep people hooked for right around 100 hours of actual gameplay.
Wow.
So that would be kind of the baseline expectation here. But really, it's the kind of game that is going to have one group of people that are playing it, you know, probably through to the end of the year, just because it's pretty and immersive and that kind of thing. But there are a lot of people who will just kind of play right through the story. And so you'll have, you know, probably 30 to 40 hours with those kind of people.
Okay. And you said it's just come out. Are there any reviews? What are people saying?
Oh, yeah, so this is going to come to the Xbox at the end of this week. It's going to come out on January 26th.
Okay.
And so far, it's just been a lot of really positive commentary. You know, I've played it for a few hours and it's very, very pretty, playing with a group of people is something that I haven't been able to do yet, but it's something I'm definitely looking forward to doing. And it is, if you enjoyed games like Horizon Zero Dawn for the PlayStation 4, this is very similar in its ability to just kind of get you to stare at the screen and go, wow, this thing is really pretty.
Is there an optimum number of people you like to play in a game with?
Personally, I play most games solo player.
Okay.
I don't do a ton of online gameplay unless it's unless I have people that are, you know, like my close friends that I will play with for, you know, specific periods of time. But I don't usually jump online with a random group of people. So it's a little different for me for this kind of experience. I have to know that it's something that my friends are also interested in.
Okay, gotcha. You recently wrote a guide for virtual reality in kids. What are some of the concerns with kids using VR?
Well, the biggest thing with kids using VR is eye strain. You know, anytime you have, this is a very similar conversation to what we had when the original Nintendo 3DS came out, is that, you know, creating this kind of artificial depth for young eyes can make it easy for those eyes to, lack focus or have trouble, training in the way that they're supposed to, and so it can affect the development of those eyes over an extended period of time. So I was a little concerned about what virtual reality headsets would do for kids, especially since what we saw during CES a couple weeks ago were headsets being specifically targeted for 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea here was to figure out what specifically was okay for kids. And after talking to a couple of pediatricians and doing a bunch of research on how, eye development works, ran into a very similar strategy for keeping your kids healthy that you did with the Nintendo 3DS, which is to make sure that kids are taking, firm breaks at least once an hour, and that they're not playing for more than, two or three hours in a given day. And you're avoiding the risk of actual damage to your child's eyes. But if you hand a VR headset to a kid and they sit in that headset for, an entire day playing games, then it has the potential to be kind of dangerous to their eyesight.
We will have a link to Russell's article about a guide for virtual reality and kids on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Russell Holly, thanks as always. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.